One of America's persistent myths is that the first European migrants to the so-called New World found a largely uninhabited continent. In a new documentary, today's guest brings alive the thriving cities, social networks, art, and science of Native America. He's Gary Glassman this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, authors, journalists, filmmakers, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Gary Glassman, a veteran documentary filmmaker whose latest film, Native America, is a four-part documentary to be released this season on public television. Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk about the film Native America. It's going to premiere in October 23rd on PBS. We want to come to that. But let's start sort of with you and your origins as a filmmaker. Were you one of these people who made films as a kid that you knew you always wanted to be a filmmaker?
Well, I always wanted to be a filmmaker, but never believed I actually could, because I'm born in the Bronx and grew up in Buffalo, and guys like me usually don't go to Hollywood and make films. But my earliest days, I would kick out old TV screens and do puppet shows in them. So that was my earliest introduction to television. But the big innovation in my life that brought me into TV was VHS. VHS, for me, represented the democratization of production and distribution, and I could afford to get myself a VHS camera and, edit system and start working that way.
How old were you when you were investing in filmmaking?
Oh, gosh, I guess I was probably in my late 20s.
Okay. Now, in your bio, it says that for a time you actually were in a clown circus. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. It was an all-clown circus. It was called the Two-Penny Circus. There were eight of us. We did a clown and Commedia dell'arte show. We toured all over the States and Europe. We were kind of a proto Cirque du Soleil.
And so does that kind of experience inform you, or sort of does that contribute to your filmmaking?
I think so. I mean, I think my commitment is to popular entertainment. So puppets, clowning, street performance, and television. Mm-hmm. So I think they're all sort of in the same realm of engaging the biggest audience possible. Mm.
And along the way, you got a degree at UCLA, is that correct?
Do we have
that
correct? I after my clowning and street performance days, I went to UCLA. I got an MFA in directing at UCLA.
When was that? What time? What era?
That was 80. I graduated from there in, I think it was 84.
Okay. And then at some point after that, you were in Paris. Is that not correct?
Yeah, that was just before I got here to Providence. I met my wife. She wasn't my wife when we met, actually. We met in L.A., and she had a position at the Sorbonne the following year, and so I kind of hustled my a friend to commission me to do a screenplay, and I went off to Paris.
Very nice. And then you came back here when, as I understand it, your wife received her professorship at Providence College. That's how you wound up?
When we were in Paris, I thought if things worked out between us, we'd move back to L.A. together. But she got a job offer at a place called Providence, Rhode Island. And here we landed. It took me a little while to unpack my bags. I actually looked for even jobs as a Cadillac salesman. I never thought I'd make media here in Providence, but I kind of hooked up with documentary community up in the Boston area, and I was actually a pretty hot editor coming out of L.A., and I got a job on a new series for Discovery Channel, and me and my producing partner at the time were sort of the dynamic duo of the Discover magazine series for Discovery Channel.
And so now you've made more than 50 films. Your latest is Native America, which is a look at pre-Columbian America. Is that?
Well, we initially, when we defined it, we thought of pre-contact. Yes, the world of the Americas before Columbus. But the more we immersed ourselves in the content and very specifically engaging with Native communities, we kind of left Columbus behind. I think we might mention him once in the entire series, and really flipped it to the world created by America's First Peoples. Mm. I mean, the idea was that here was a world that was totally cut off from Europe and Asia and Africa geographically for millions of years, and from a human population standpoint, it was cut off
millennia for sure.
At least 25,000 years.
Right.
So it was a world that developed all in and of itself, practically a parallel world to the rest of the world, and it developed in a way that is unique to the Americas. The basic premise for it and the basic idea for it came when I was doing actually my first Nova in about the year 2000, and it was on a Maya king. A tomb was found, and I had a scoop to go down and film it. And I'm crawling around in a tomb of the dynastic founder of Copan, this jewel of a city in Honduras, and here are these incredible temple pyramids, beautiful sculpture and paintings, a writing system that was, one of the only unique original writing systems in the entire world, and astronomical knowledge that surpassed Europe at the time. This is the year 400 when the Copan dynasty started. And I just was wondering, where did this all begin? And is there a connection between what's happening in Central America with North and South America? So the seed of the idea actually was planted right there in that tomb from 400 CE.
Among the many issues and topics that you get into is the social networking of these various Native American peoples from South America to North America. How did that work? How did one culture from, say, Central America communicate with a culture in Southwestern North America and so forth? I mean, that was astounding. I had no idea that there was this vast communication and cultural exchange.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the where that question came from was that as I started diving into the content about are these beliefs and cultures shared across North and South America, I quickly, through conversations with Native scholars and non-Native scholars, it was confirmed that yes, there is. You could say that there is a foundational belief system that's shared across the Americas with a diversity of expression. So then it became a question of, well, what is that belief system and how was it shared? And that's where some of the stories actually came from. So, for instance, in the first hour, we establish the foundational belief system and this concept that it is in fact shared. And we do it at a place called Chaco Canyon in New Mexico. And we do it with the Hopi people. And what we learned through our collaboration with our Hopi friends is that in Hopi tradition, Chaco Canyon, which was built around the year 1000 and had a population of about 20,000 people, was a center for sharing knowledge about nature and the powers of nature. And it's a strong tradition amongst the Pueblo people, of whom the Hopi are part of. But part of the concept for our series was that we were going to be looking at the Americas through the lens of native knowledge and modern scholarship. Well, there was a discovery, an archaeological discovery made there at Chaco, where they found these cylindrical pots that resemble the shape of pots that are only found in the Maya area, about 1,000 miles away. And in those pots, they found the residue of cacao, which is the ingredient that makes chocolate. Mm-hmm. Now, cacao grows over 1,000 miles away. So clearly, there was some kind of exchange going on where people were coming with these materials. But these materials were not, it wasn't just cacao. It was shells, shell ornaments carved, and the shells originated from the Pacific and the Gulf of Mexico. There was tropical birds that were brought from South America, and many other kinds of objects that were found there in Chaco that came from thousands of miles away. But these weren't objects that represented some kind of, you know, valuable jewel or something like that. They didn't have a monetary value. They had a cultural value. They represented scientific and spiritual ideas that centered around the forces of nature.
One of the things that I think you get to in the film is the sort of the engineering marvels, right? These were civilizations with large cities, with monuments of construction that still exist today. If you think about the pyramids in parts of Central and South America, what tell us more about what you learned and sort of what we know about these societies as a result of these testaments to organization and engineering skill.
Well, it was a surprise to me. And I'm sure it's going to be a surprise to the television audiences that, North and South America had some of the largest cities in the world during their time. We filmed in a place called Teotihuacan, which is outside of Mexico City. It's an extraordinary city of pyramids and housing and the year 100, there were 150,000 people living there.
Wow, 150,000?
Yeah. It was one of the largest cities in the world at that time. It was a cultural center. In the same way that Chaco people would come from thousands of miles mm-hmm. to be at Chaco, people were coming to Teotihuacan. And what's extraordinary about it, one of the extraordinary things about it, is that it is aligned to celestial events. First of all, it mirrors the natural world around it. So the pyramids kind of mirror certain sacred mountains that are on the horizon. And the entire city is a giant calendar, a synchronized calendar that is synchronized to the solar calendar, but also a sacred calendar of the of many of the indigenous people of Mesoamerica. It's one that represents the human gestation. So there are two kind of synchronized calendars that almost work in a sort of a gear system. And at certain points where they align, there were major festivals. And those alignments always occurred with major celestial events.
And some of the promotional stuff that I've seen, it looks like you use some animation and some essentially renderings of what these urban centers look like. From a storytelling perspective, what does that get you that you can't get from just showing the, you know, the ruins of the temples that still exist?
Well, it's one of the challenges of making any kind of historical documentary is how do you bring the past alive for a television audience, and animation, both 2D animation and 3D animation, are powerful tools for that. But all of our 3D animation was done in collaboration with the foremost archaeologists in those specific areas.
Because the authenticity has to be legitimate, right?
Because
otherwise it's just sort of a fanciful rendering.
Yeah, no, this is not fantasy. This is the best possible estimation of what these places look like. One place that just totally blew my mind is there's a city called Cahokia. It too was around the year 1000. It was it's outside of St. Louis, Missouri. It was a city of over 100 pyramids, earthen mounds, aligned to celestial events, moon, sun, certain constellations. It was the largest city in North America, north of Mexico City, until Philadelphia surpassed it in the 19th century.
Wow.
That's incredible. I think this is going to be such an experience for viewers. So let's roll the beginning of episode one from Caves to Cosmos, which answers a 15,000-year-old question: who were America's first peoples? So in doing this film, in creating this film, which took many years, as you've already alluded to, you were careful and careful to involve indigenous peoples, from the narrator to musicians to events and ceremonies that you witnessed. Talk about that, how that adds to the authenticity, and also how you got the cooperation of a vast number of different Native Americans living today, obviously.
Well, my first hire was my series producer, Juliana Branham, who's Comanche and who has independent filmmaking and PBS experience. And we and my entire team at Providence Pictures cast a really wide net in terms of research. But Juliana and I went out and met with many Native communities to talk about what our vision was for the series, that it truly would be an authentic vehicle for Native knowledge, and asked what these communities would want other people to know. What knowledge they would be willing to share. And so we spent at least a year just talking to people, going out, talking to Native people, going out, hearing their stories, working out what they were willing to share. The communities through faith keepers, leaders, just community members were involved in the entire process. So each hour we had at least one Native consultant from the community in which we were closely working, and made sure that whatever we were going to be broadcasting would be authentic, and that we weren't showing anything that they wouldn't want to be seen.
So in that early stage of gaining trust, you had to essentially sell yourself. I mean, there have been so many negative images of Native Americans historically, if you look at media and certainly Hollywood going back, that here's the stranger who shows up. And so you had to build trust. Is that not correct?
For sure. I mean, yeah. that's the bottom line. And, you know, it's not, first of all, the distrust from the Native community is totally understandable. I mean, 500 years
of
genocidal, you know, warfare and politics has contributed to that mistrust. And so there's every reason to not trust anybody else to tell their story but themselves. But this was the people who chose to participate and share their knowledge have, I think, a mission to, you know, I mean, it may sound simplistic, but many of the Native cultures see themselves as protectors of the earth and see it as a responsibility to, you know, take care of all living things. And I think many of them understand that we are in a crisis now in terms of our environment, and they have incredible knowledge that could be very helpful to everybody.
You know, one of the things that struck me was you tell the story of a Native population in upstate New York that was developing democracy 500 years before the Declaration of Independence. Share a little bit of that story with our audience.
Yeah, that's the Haudenosaunee. They're often called the Iroquois or Five or Six Nations. Mm-hmm. They live in upstate New York, and the central nation amongst them are the Onondaga, and they have the story of the peacemaker and Hiawatha. For generations, the five nations, the Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Oneida, and Mohawk were fighting amongst themselves. And it was brutal. And the peacemaker comes and recruits Hiawatha as a disciple. And they spread the message of peace amongst all of the warring tribes. There's one holdout, and it happens to be the warlord of the Onondaga people. And finally, he's convinced, the story of the coming together, the end of war, and the coming together and the formation of the first democracy is memorialized in something called a wampum belt. It's a tapestry of shell beads that represent the story. And just 2 weeks ago, annually, the different communities come together and have a reading, a recitation of the Great Law of Peace, which is the rules of how to get along and the foundation of democracy. So when the founding fathers, came to the Americas, they heard of this democracy. It's a three-part democracy that our U.S. Constitution and three branches of government very closely mirror. Two incredible, and there's plenty of evidence of this exchange. It's, in fact, in Philadelphia, the founding fathers gave a house to the Haudenosaunee to come and be close to advise them on how to write the Constitution.
Wow, boy, this is unknown until now.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, the one they have a couple other parts of their governance that maybe we could learn from. One is that women are kind of like the Supreme Court in the sense that the clan mothers serve for life, and they can appoint and impeach the chiefs if the chiefs are not serving the people. And the other is that there's a sacred commitment to taking care of all living things.
Message for today from the past in America.
Well, and the thing is, they're still alive and well.
Absolutely.
And they're a sovereign. They are, in fact, a sovereign nation. They don't vote in our elections. They have their own form of government. They have their own passports. Their relationship with the U.S. is the same as if they were Canada or Mexico. They have treaties.
Sovereign nations, yeah. Gary Glassman, the film is Native America. It's on PBS beginning in October. Thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us next time for more Story in the Public Square.